Hi, everyone. I'm Logan Medish, your host of the High Caliber History Podcast. And my guest today is the curator of the world's largest privately held firearms collection. Make sure you give us a like or a review when you're done with this episode and share it with someone who you think might enjoy it as well. And now let's get into the episode. Hi, everyone. My name is Logan Medish. I'm the host of the High Caliber History Podcast, and my guest today is my good friend, Jason Schubert. He's been the curator of the J.M. Davis Arms and Historical Museum in Claremore, Oklahoma, since 2006. He has a B.A. in History and an M.A. in Museum Science and was previously the director of museums for Philmont Scout Ranch, where he oversaw three museum sites. He's also been on a number of television shows, ranging from local Oklahoma stations all the way to a television network in Japan. International star Jason, welcome to the High Caliber History Podcast, my friend.
Thank you, Logan. Appreciate you having me here.
Absolutely,
it's good to talk with you again. It's been a while.
Yeah,
I have been here since, well, it's exactly 14 years now.
Well, happy anniversary.
Thank you very much. It's been a lot of fun, a lot of neat things to see, and as we like to say here, we are the largest privately held collection of firearms in the world. The vast majority were collected by one man, J.M. Davis, John Monroe Davis, and he was kind of pretty interesting guy. He grew up in Arkansas and studied business and bookkeeping, and 1916 he was heading towards Tulsa to get in on the business boom that was going on with the oil boom in Tulsa, and made it as far as Claremore, Oklahoma, stayed in a hotel called the Mason Hotel, and thought, you know what, I don't have to go all the way to Tulsa. This is a pretty neat looking business, and so he bought the place.
Very cool.
And so I'm going to skip back a little bit earlier to when JM was a child. He was 7 years old. He had been pretty sick as a child, had to take a lot of medicines, been in the hospital a lot. Finally had to take one more medicine, and as I tell the kids that come and visit, it was back before they had wonderful flavors in medicine, and it was all icky medicine tasting, and so he threw a temper tantrum and wouldn't take any more of the nasty medicine. The doctors told him, look, if this kid doesn't take his medicine, he's not going to make it. And so his parents did what any good parents would do in such a situation. They resorted to bribery. Dad came up and said, all right, kid, I know you've been wanting this gun in town, and if you take your medicine and get better, I'll buy you the gun. And so young Monroe took his medicine, got better, and Dad came through with the deal and bought him a muzzle-loading shotgun, and it's about a 41 caliber, you know, essentially a muzzle-loading 410. Percussion lock, little short kids shotgun, and he kept that gun all his life. We still have it in the collection, and it is on exhibit today. And
Very cool. So
his parents had no idea that this would start the largest privately held collection of firearms in the world. And so here we are today.
That's amazing. Now, you say the largest collection. How many guns do you guys have there?
We have about 11,000.
11,000.
Now,
that's awesome.
Independent studio services may be getting up there or may have surpassed it. I'm not exactly sure, but you can't just come visit their, you know, them. They don't have a museum or anything. So,
we're
still going to hold on to that title.
Gotcha. Yeah. And for those of you who don't know, Independent Studio Services, or ISS as we often call it, that's one of the movie prop companies.
Yeah.
And so they obviously have a lot of stuff as well, but they don't have, I don't think they have anywhere near the cool historic stuff that you guys have in the museum there. There is a lot of fantastic stuff in the museum. Starting, you guys have, it's an M41 tank sitting out front, right?
Yes, we do. On loan from the United States Army, M41 Walker Bulldog. That's right. They don't give anything away. it's a permanent long-term loan. It's a neat thing to have a tank sitting right out on Route 66. I mean, what else could you ask for?
Yeah, man. Cruising America's highway and seeing an American tank.
That's right.
Doesn't get much more American than that.
That's right. Yeah. Great stuff.
Yeah. So one of the questions I wanted to ask is, since you've got your degrees in history and museum science, for you, what came first? Was it your interest in firearms or your interest in museums? And how did you marry those two together?
Married them together quite luckily, actually. Interest first was probably firearms, and then history, and then museums. But growing up, my dad taught me about firearms. First thing is safety, like we all learned, and then appreciation for guns, and then learning the firearms of military, and of course it all goes back with seeing things on TV. What is that thing? Well, son, that's it. Appreciating history, whether it's from starting off with a war movie or a Western, what have you, even, seeing the prop guns in Star Wars, which almost all of those are taken from old military guns.
Right.
And learning that stuff, appreciating the firearms and then the history, evolving that. And there came a point in my studies of history that I realized I don't have the talents to be a classroom teacher or a classroom professor. God bless the teachers. God bless the instructors. I just can't teach that way.
A man's got to know his limitations, right?
Amen. And that's one of them. Started into some living history, fur trade era stuff, teaching with that. And of course, there's firearms involved in that, and doing public speaking through that living history, and realized real quickly, I can teach with these artifacts, and that's how it put into the in with the museums. I was taking a junior or senior level class on the Plains Indians, and there was a fella sitting in on the class, and turns out he was taking the same course but for graduate credit, so he had to do a lot more work than the rest of us did, and he was actually the curator at the Museum of Texas Tech University, Henry Crawford, and got to be good friends with him, and we had a similar love of fur trade, and then the guns came in, and he said, you ought to think about museum science. And so I started looking into it, and they have a museum science program right there at the Museum of Texas Tech University. So didn't have to travel for grad school, got my started working there or studying there, and worked for Henry several semesters during my graduate program. And I was at a few museums here and there after I graduated, and this position became available, and I thought, hey, it's guns, it's museums, it's not too far away from family, and so hey, this is perfect. And so 14 years later, here I am.
There you go. Yeah, time flies when you're having fun, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Very cool. So we talked about the first gun in the museum's collection, mm-hmm. which would have been the gun that Mr. Davis got for taking his medicine.
Yeah.
What is the oldest gun in the collection?
The oldest is a Chinese hand cannon from the 1340s, 1350s, somewhere around in there. And it is just the plugged up bronze tube, you know, with a touch hole, essentially.
Gotcha. Where did he purchase most of his stuff from?
I wish I knew. He didn't. He did not keep records, and so we just don't know. He was constantly buying, selling, trading, and it just, you know, we don't know all the sources.
Sure.
But there in his hotel, you know, he owned about 100 guns when he bought the hotel. And so I'm sure Mrs. Davis said, "Why don't you get that stuff out of my house?" You know? And, and so he, decorated the walls of the hotel with his then 100 guns. And, people started seeing that, "Hey, there's this funky museum in Claremore that's got all these guns." And Davis would, you know, he was an active trader, and so he was buying things constantly. When the Depression came along, he would take a gun or something in trade for a night stay at the hotel, a meal in the coffee shop, or even a month's rent in one of the rent houses that he owned here in Claremore. And so, you know, he wasn't a native Oklahoman, but he realized too many Oklahomans were leaving the state and heading west to pick peaches in California. And, you know, it just, you know, we couldn't empty the state. That's not a good thing to do, but, you know, right. just because folks don't have cash money. So he took things in trade and let folks stay a little longer. And, the collection just exploded. However, Mrs. Davis did have to pull in the reins a little bit. She limited him to about $3,000 worth of purchases each month, and, you know, 1930s, $3,000 a month.
Yeah. It's a sizable chunk of change back then.
Yes, it
especially
is.
During
yes,
the Depression.
It is. Absolutely. And then about a third of that he would trade away again. So his trading stock was enormous. And the thing about Davis is he'd take about anything in trade. And so while several museums will have beautiful, polished, perfect art pieces of guns, our collection is working man's guns, everyday guns. I mean, the kind of things that were used. And that's what I like, is one of our, you know, one of the neat things that I see is when people come to the museum, they're walking around looking at down the aisles, and somebody will point out and say, "Man, I had one of these when I was a kid," or "Grandpa yeah. had one of these, and it's now in the family." And so, you know, and so let's learn about this. You know, just today had a fella and his son, teenage son, come in, and they have these two rusted up barreled actions. One is an 03 Springfield, and the other was a number 4 Enfield. And no wood at all, just the barreled action, and they were pretty rugged on the outside. But the son had been working on them, and, you know, putting the penetrating oil in, trying to clean them up, and wanted to see what they really look like. And so he's deciding, do I want to find stocks, original stock and hardware for these, and try to restore them to their original appearance? Or do I want to make a truck gun out of it or something, or a sporterized thing, something that I could, you know, hunt whitetail with? And, you know, that's since they're already in rough condition and there's no wood, you know, you don't have ethical dilemma of sporterizing a military surplus item.
And right.
So, you could do something, you know, either way, clean it all up. You're going to have a good shooting gun.
Sure.
So it's kind of neat to meet people like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, like you said, the working man's collection, people are seeing stuff that they saw in their home. And that really, I think, and I have felt it, you know, it provides a very different connection than, you know, like say if you went to the Metropolitan Museum in New York, you know, they've got beautiful stuff there. I mean, they've got Smith & Wesson revolvers with, you know, beautiful carved grips of gold and silver from Tiffany and Company. And it's, you know, it's gorgeous stuff,
yeah.
But I can't relate to that. You know, I can relate to it on an artistic level and a museum and appreciation level. But I certainly don't have anything like that in my safe, you know,
and you don't want to shoot it. You go, oh gosh, I'm going to break it. You know,
exactly.
And then the shooter in you once says, well, what good is it?
Right. Like, exactly.
I want to go shoot that thing, you know? Yeah.
Right. Yeah, there's a time and a place for a safe queen,
yes.
But there's also something to say to have stuff in a collection for consumptive use.
Yes, yes.
And I guess that brings up an interesting thing, because you guys do have such a large collection, and it is not a collection of safe queens. Do you guys have like a learning collection, you know, stuff that you do perform consumptive use with that you actually shoot on occasion or anything?
Well, we don't do any shooting, but we do have a small amount of replica percussion revolvers that were donated to us for the sake of being an educational collection. So, you know, it's something that we can let visitors handle, and if the hammer slips and it mushrooms the nipple, who cares?
You know,
not a big deal. And also we've recently got some things, some neat items that came in from that same sort of concept. These are some inert but exact material of explosives, mines, and things. Let me show you here. Yeah, I don't know if this is.
Yeah. Very
and
cool.
So, yeah, I mean, there's a VC stick grenade made out of a Pabst Blue Ribbon can. I mean, you know, and then that one there at the end is a VC practice stick grenade.
Okay.
So, you know, so yeah, it's a weighted pineapple, but you know, it's not a real, nothing's real other than you can practice your throwing on it. So,
gotcha.
And the man that collected them and donated them to us, it's been a hobby of his of making these, and getting these pieces, the exact, you know, the actual thing, but not, you know, not having to have conversations with the ATF about it. And his thought was, I want to give them to you guys so that maybe some local law enforcement can use them as teaching aids, learning aids, and, you know, because, you know, unfortunately, lawmen see these things occasionally. You know, you wouldn't think about it, but these things are going to pop up. You know, machine guns pop up and stuff. So, you know, you kind of want to know what these things look like, what they really are, and you know, maybe is this real? Is it just fake? So, you know, so it is. That is part of our learning collection, but then also, like I said, the percussion revolvers are, you know, it is a very small collection. So,
gotcha. Cool. So now the museum itself there has an interesting, I guess, partnership is what I'm going to call it. You can correct me if that's not the accurate term, but you're a privately held collection, but yet you guys are also very closely tied with the state of Oklahoma, almost kind of married together, I would say. So how does that work? How is it that you're privately held but also affiliated with the state?
Okay. Well, as Mr. Davis got older, he realized his collection was a little bit more immortal than he was. He didn't have any children. His first wife passed away. He remarried and no children. He had some nieces and nephews on his side of the family, and actually both of his wives, they were lateral descendants, but he didn't have any children, so no one to pass this on to. And he had offers made to him to sell this or sell parts of it, break up the collection, but he didn't want that to happen. He realized how important this was as a tourist destination for Claremore. I mean, you know, Route 66 opened up in what, 1923? By the mid-30s, the Mason Hotel and all the guns are already in travel literature.
Oh, and wow.
So this has been a important spot on Route 66 for a long time, and Davis didn't want that to end. And gotcha. So what he did was he made a deal with our local state senator at that time, and they kind of cut a deal so that what happened was Davis created a nonprofit foundation, and he served as the president of it, and he transferred his ownership of the guns to the J.M. Davis Foundation, and made a deal with the state. The foundation leased J.M. Davis's collection to the state of Oklahoma for a term of 99 years for the whopping sum of $1.
And, how about that?
Yeah. And so the deal was that the state was to build a building, exhibit the collection, and provide a staff to take care of it. And so that's where we are. The building we are in is a state building, state property. I'm a state employee. Yeah. And but we are the stewards of this collection. It's leased to us. And so we've been open for about 52 years now. So we've got a little bit more time on the lease, and there's always option to renew the lease after the 99 years is up. So,
sure.
But so he was pretty far thinking in making that deal, and glad that it worked out.
Cool. Yeah. So you guys are in a state-owned building now. Mm-hmm. What happened to the hotel? Is it still around?
No, it's not. Unfortunately, Mr. Davis spent more money on guns and beer steins than he did on maintenance of the building. And it was an old wooden building built about 1910. And just it didn't hold up. After the guns left the museum, or excuse me, left the hotel to come to the museum, it didn't really serve much of a purpose anymore. And I'm not originally from Claremore, so I'm going by history of what people have told me. But kind of in the late 80s, it was essentially condemned and torn down. A shopping center was built on that block, and that was what it looked like when I came here. It was kind of a small strip center with some businesses in it, and then that folded and was torn down, and today there's a pharmacy on that block. So but we can, you know, we're only two blocks away, block and a half away from it, so when folks come in our front door, they get the spiel about the museum's history and about Mr. Davis. We can point through the windows and say, over there at that pharmacy, that's where the hotel was originally. So, you know, it's, you know, the collection has not left downtown Claremore. And so it's kind of nice that it's all still here. And, yeah.
And especially with a collection that size, to not have to move it that far is definitely a plus. It's a pain to move it at all.
Absolutely.
But thankfully, you didn't have to go far. Just down the street, that's that's an easy one in the grand scheme of things. You mentioned that there is a new exhibit getting ready to open up at the museum. Yep. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I've had a... It's had kind of a one case exhibit up on the attempts to circumvent the Roland White patent. And I know we've, you know, you and I have talked about, it's one of our favorite topics, and it's, it's one of those things that gun history guys go nuts over, and some people just don't understand. but it's been up for about a year now, and so I'm gonna be taking that down, and I'm gonna be putting in some items that what I'm gonna call it is the guns that Hollywood made famous. And okay. So unfortunately, we don't have any actual "this gun was in this movie." What it is this is the kind of gun that was in this role. And so, you know, of course, Walter PPK, James Bond, the Frankie Spaz 12, Jurassic Park, and the Desert Eagle, every Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. but things like the Mauser C-96 is the Han Solo gun.
Right, it's the Star Wars blaster, yep.
Right, or the P-38 is the Man from U.N.C.L.E. gun, or guys in our generation, Megatron.
Right.
Yeah. So
connect with everybody, right?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, it's you have to, because, you know, if you don't, I mean, first of all, you don't get people in to see your museum.
Sure.
You don't get people learning history. You don't get people learning about the firearms. And, you know, it amazes me how many young folks will come in and say, "Oh man, I shot that gun." I said, "Really? That's great. Yeah, on Call of Duty." Okay.
Yeah.
Well, they didn't really shoot it, but they learned about it.
Exactly. And they recognized it.
Yes. Yes. Yep. And, you know, yes, even though it's a video game, they know the stats on it. And, you know, and so they're like, "Oh, this one does this. And I'm like, "Yeah, you're absolutely correct." So, but they're learning about it.
Sure.
And from there, they can see the real thing and say, "Oh my gosh, it's really that huge," or, you know, whatever. And, so that's kind of what I'm doing with this and the movie guns. Going to be putting a Webley Fosbury revolver out for the old film noir Maltese Falcon fans. And
I love that gun.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it's like, you know, I've heard it said that this was a solution to a problem that nobody asked, a question nobody asked.
Exactly.
But in all honesty, when you're up in a rickety old Sopwith Camel and Jerry's bearing down on you and you've got a pistol and you're going to shoot him, you don't want a semi-automatic that's going to eject hot brass into your flimsy wooden and canvas aircraft. And the Webley Fosbury had a practical application. You could shoot six rounds and no hot brass goes flying around. You empty them all out when you want real quickly by breaking open that action, pop six more in, and boom, you're good to go.
Yeah.
But then, you know, you look at, Humphrey Bogart and say, you know, the old Webley Fosbury, they don't make them anymore. So, okay, well, what the heck does it look like? And then you see one, and you're like, "Oh, okay, that's strange, but pretty cool."
Exactly. So, yeah. And then, yeah. you know, and yeah, the Fosbury's strange but cool. And then the Fosbury starts to look rather normal if you compare it to the Mateba, which is the other semi-automatic revolver. And, and then you look at them side by side and you go, huh, the Fosbury doesn't look so strange anymore.
No. Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Well, that's cool. Yeah. So that exhibit will be opening up sometime after the first of the year, or?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So very cool.
Yeah. And we're also, I'm not sure how much I'm supposed to talk about this, but we're working on, hopefully by March, looking on having an exhibit of some guns as well as belongings and awards of a very famous country and western performer who passed away a couple of years ago, lived in Tulsa, Oklahoma, liked to pick and grin, and
you can read between the lines,
read between the lines, and was a one-time owner of the Tulsa Drillers baseball team, and sang at Mickey Mantle's funeral, you know, so do your homework, and we might have, hopefully everything works out, we're going to be having this exhibit come March, and so we're really excited about that.
Yeah. Absolutely. That'll be awesome for to have this unnamed individual's stuff in there is going to be really, really cool. Definitely looking forward to that. So once everyone's getting out and traveling again, got to come see your new Hollywood guns style exhibit and your new country western star exhibit. Hey,
absolutely. So we'll be getting press out on that when we get closer to it. So
awesome. Yep. Now everyone has a favorite kid. Even if they won't admit it, even if they won't admit it, everyone's got kid. And so I'm not going to make you tell me your favorite kid at the collection. Instead, aside from the J.M. Davis collection, do you have a favorite museum or firearms collection?
That's hard to say. I don't know. I haven't been out to Fairfax, and unfortunately I haven't been able to stop at Springfield. Been in the area a little bit, but then Cody's, been up there a few years ago. We had a museum, gun museum conference up there a few years ago, and I was able to make, so that was a real nice collection. I haven't seen it since they've had the, all the refurbishing, from what I see on TV, it looks really great. So
it does look really great. Yeah, they did a great job with it.
Yeah. So
absolutely.
But as far as like a favorite gun here in this collection, I like weird things, and one of my favorites has always been that little marble game getter. I don't know why it's just a funky little gun. It's kind of cool. It folds up in your back. Maybe it's the Transformer James Bond thing that I grew up on. So here's something that will, fold up and fit in your pack and has enough oomph to get you something to eat if you're stuck out in the snow, or dispatch something that you caught in your trap line. So marble game getter's always been one of those cool things that I like. So I'm going to have to go with that one.
Yeah, that's a good choice. I like that one. And then one more big question, and this one's probably going to be a little bit harder, but I ask everyone on the podcast this question.
Okay.
Who is a famous gun designer that you would want to meet, living or dead, and why?
Ooh,
it's tougher than favorite kid.
Yeah, it is. I'm gonna have to say Mikhail Kalashnikov.
Okay.
I'd like to talk with him. There's so many stories about what he, about him figuring out the AK-47. Mm-hmm. One, I'd like to see, is it real or is it propaganda? You know, he was laid up in bed after the end of the Great War, and you know, and was tinkering with things and made the gun for the motherland. And I'd also heard a story, and again, I'd like to know if it's true, that later in his life, he grew in his faith and was talking to his priest one day and said, "Father, I created something that has been made in the millions and has killed millions of people. Is God going to hold that against me?" Mm. And the story goes that the priest said, "No, you made something to protect your homeland. And God calls us to protect our homeland. Mm-hmm. If somebody uses it in an incorrect way, that's between them and God. But you made something for your country to stay safe." Mm-hmm. So you're okay with God on that issue. And so I just wondered if that really happened. Right. That's kind of one of the many urban legends in the gun community.
Gotcha. Yeah, certainly, especially with someone like Kalashnikov and being in the Soviet Union, there's tons mm-hmm. of propaganda, you know, yeah. for decades and decades. And yeah, it would be really cool to sort that out and figure out. That's cool. Well, that Kalashnikov has not been chosen by anyone yet, so that's okay. That's good. That's always a good choice, you know. Yeah. Him and Crowning and Colt and Smith and Wesson are all guys I'd like to meet. But but Mikhail would definitely be a cool one.
Yeah,
sounds good. All right. Well, thank you, Jason Schubert, the curator of the J.M. Davis Arms and Historical Museum. Jason, I really appreciate you coming on the podcast. It's been fantastic chatting with you, my friend.
Well, thank you, Logan. I appreciate you asking me. It was good to come and talk with you. And it's been too long, brother. I hadn't seen you in a while. And it's good to see you and good to talk with you face to face instead of the usual keyboard commandoing over Facebook.
Yep, absolutely. Thanks again, Jason.
All right. Take care, man.
Yep, you too. Bye-bye. Bye. Thanks for tuning into this episode with Jason Schubert of the J.M. Davis Museum in Claremore, Oklahoma. If you're interested in learning more about the museum, you can find them online at thegunmuseum.com. That URL doesn't get any easier, thegunmuseum.com. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you right here next week. Have a great day.